So today I'm going to be talking about this mirror applied to critical theories in one dimension. So these are conformal field theories. And I'm using the lattice version of the mirror because it's safe and it's nice. It's not scary like the continuum. So immediately you might be thinking, this doesn't sound like a good idea. So the most important aspect of a conformal field theory is probably this notion of scale invariance. So my system or my state is invariant under changes of scale. So and putting that on the lattice, trying to do that in the lattice, seems like a bad idea. But as we'll see, you can still make sense of this change of scale, the scale invariance on the lattice. And this mirror does a very good job of that. So what I'm going to be talking about today, I'm going to start off just going quickly again over some of these things Giffre talked about, so probably won't need a lot of explanation there. Talk about a scale invariant mirror and how it relates to conformal field theory, or how we can extract conformal data from a model of interest using this approach. I'm also going to talk about CFTs in the presence of an impurity. So here I'm going to introduce some principle of minimal influence in the RG flow, and this is very important in allowing us to analyze impurities with the mirror. And I think this principle is quite general in that this could also be something useful in the continuum version of the mirror. And so this is work done in collaboration with Giffre, and also some of it was in collaboration with Robert Pfeiffer, who is also now at Perimeter. Okay, let's get started. So I'm going to be using this ternary implementation of the mirror that Giffre explained. So it's built from two different types of tensors, these isometries and disentanglers. And of course, ternary mirror, because we're choosing our isometries to map three legs, three sites into one site at each level. Okay, so ternary mirror is a state for my lattice, and I'm going to potentially label each layer of this mirror as a U. Okay, and as Giffre explained, we also have to put these isometric or unitary constraints on our tensors. So Giffre explained what that meant. So an important something that comes out of putting these isometric constraints on your tensors and the structure of this network is you have a causal cone, a bounded causal cone. So Giffre explained this already. The causal cone is the set of tensors that could affect the density matrix evaluated on this site. So the density matrix on two sites is what happens when you put the bra in the kit and you trace out everything except these two sites. Okay, and the causal cone is in purple, and I'll just quickly reiterate the same argument as Giffre done. So put my bra in my kit, and I've traced out everything that doesn't belong to these two sites, so I want to evaluate the density matrix on. And as Giffre already explained, everything outside of this causal cone annihilates because of these constraints we put on the tensors. So it simplifies to only the tensors in the causal cone survive. Okay, so in the ternary mirror, we have a causal cone that involves only two sites at each level. And this bounded causal width, as Giffre explained, is the key property that allows us to efficiently evaluate local observables from the mirror. Okay. At this point, I'm also going to introduce, so I hope everyone at this stage is familiar with the notation used for tensor networks. So now I'm going to introduce a slightly different pictorial notation used for operators on the lattice. So I think Giffre already did this, but I'm going to, so when I have, say, a Hamiltonian, that it's the sum of nearest neighbor terms, I'm just going to draw it as the set of ovals here. I hope that's clear for everyone. So each of these ovals represents one of these nearest neighbor couplings in my system. And as Giffre explained, each layer of the mirror, one of these U's, can be thought of as some coarse graining transformation for operators living on some coarser lattice, operators living on an initial lattice to some a new operator living on a coarser lattice. So Giffray explained this. And in particular, if I have a local Hamiltonian on this initial lattice, then this layer of the mirror describes some coarse graining transformation between my initial Hamiltonian and some coarser Hamiltonian up there. And because of these isometric constraints on these tensors, this new Hamiltonian is also a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. Yep. But it may have this coupling up here may be a different coupling than what we had down here. Yep. In particular, so in this case, each of these new effective couplings results from sort of the sum of three of these coarse grained couplings from this initial lattice. Okay, so that's all of the sort of introductory material I wanted to cover. So MERA is quantum circuit with bounded causal structure, and it can also be thought of as this coarse graining transformation for lattices. So we have this complementary picture of what's going on.
You want to write this operator U formally in terms of the isometries and the distance angle. How will it look like?
To draw this properly, I should have U and the U dagger. So the other side of this and things away from here vanish to identity. So I'd actually get I'd have a sum of three things. So I'd have three different operators acting on the different contributions down there. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the scale invariant form of this ansatz. So what we can do is if we want to represent a wave function that has translation invariance, then what we can do is set the tensors along each row as the same tensor. So this one is the same as this, is the same as this, is the same as this. We can impose that our ansatz has this structure. So this, as Giffray briefly mentioned, this doesn't enforce that the state is translational invariant, but we're exploiting that our system is translation invariant. Is that? So this choice alone is not enough to ensure that our state is translation invariant, but we can always make this choice if we're working with a translation invariant system. So we also, if we want to scale invariant mirror, we enforce that different layers are exactly the same as well. Okay, so this is exactly enforcing scale invariance of our state. Some discrete scale invariance that at different length scales, it looks exactly the same. Okay, and so if we put these dual constraints on our ansatz, then this entire structure can be described by only two tensors. So even if I have an infinitely large lattice, so it extends infinitely and also infinitely upwards, it's still only described by two unique tensors here, potentially. So I'm going to... What can we say about this ansatz now that has this fixed homogeneous structure everywhere? So I'm going to evaluate the current...
There was a discussion before that, you know, these might be spin up down, but the bond dimension is bigger and interior. If I'm saying every U is the same...
I can... That'll come up in a short while. If you hold on. So it's, at the moment it just simplifies things to assume that everything is exactly the same. So let's look at evaluating a two-point correlator from the structure. So of two local operators. So I'm going to sort of cheat a little and only consider correlators on special sites that have some very simple causal structure. So this isn't necessary, it just makes it easier to show this result. Okay, so the important thing is if I put two operators d-dimensional distant in the physical lattice, then after log d coarse graining steps, they will be coarse grained onto nearest neighbor sites. Is that clear? So 27 sites apart, after three levels of this, then they are on nearest neighbor sites in my some effective lattice. Okay, so let us, so Giffray had some hand wavy thing for evaluating correlators, so let's now do it properly. So we have our bra and our kit, and we put our correlators, our observed operators, between, sandwiched between them. And because I've chosen them on simple points, the causal structure is very simple, and most of the tensors annihilate, and we get this very simple tensor network. So here, this is the density matrix for these two sites of the lattice. Okay, and at this point we can see what's happening. So I can interpret this diagram as applying some scaling super operator, some linear map for operators, to these one side operators a number of times. So I call this scaling super operator S, and it maps a one site operator to a new one side operator. And we can interpret the evaluation of this correlator as using the scaling super operator log d times to each of these initial operators. So if I want to write what's happening with my two-point correlator, I'm applying the scaling super operator log d times to the first operator, log d times to the second operator, and then I evaluate using trace against the density matrix. Is that understood?
So that's the transfer matrix I was talking about.
So this is explicitly the transfer matrix that Giffray waved his hands and said exists for this simple case. Okay. So the correct way to understand what's happening with this transfer matrix, the scaling super operator, is to consider it in the eigenbasis, some expansion over its eigenoperators. And this, so this is a very, so if I was considering, operators on other points, I would have a more complicated scaling super operator that would involve two sites. So here I'm just making life simple by considering the one site one. Yes, but the argument is the same. So the argument is that things get coarse-grained together after log d steps. That's the important bit. It's this geometric property Giffray was talking about. So if I consider the operators that get mapped into themselves, the eigenoperators of the scaling operator, I call these phi, and they come with a coefficient lambda. I'm actually going to take the log of these lambdas so these deltas, which are the log of the lambdas, call the scaling dimensions. So this will be obvious in a second why you do this.
So for example, this is the other point that you were saying, you would also draw the rectangle, right? So then it means that at least when it will stabilize and it will converge, the eigenvalues of the two objects will be somehow the same. So
for
the triangles and the squares will not be independent, they will be related.
For an optimized mirror, you can have a different scaling operator here, but it will have the same eigenvalues and eigenvectors for an optimized mirror. So not intrinsically as part of, if I just choose random tensors.
Do you choose them from the beginning so that you know that there's only the tensor constraint, the tensor problem?
No. Well, you would not know how to do that. So again, this correlator, what happens? So each time I apply the super operator to one of these scaling operators, I get a factor of lambda alpha from the left one and lambda beta from the right one. I have log d of these factors, and I'm going to get some just constant coefficient when I evaluate them at the top when they're nearest neighbors. So if I write this expression in terms of the scaling dimensions, which are the log of these lambda, so by just some simple algebra, what I get is the correlator between two scaling operators is a constant divided by d to the power of these two scaling dimensions. So two things we can say here. So first, we can show in a very nice way that for scale invariant mirror, all correlators decay polynomially. And so these scaling dimensions describe the allowed exponents for these polynomial decays. Yeah. And so this, as Giffre said in his talk, this arises as a geometric property of the mirror, that things d distant in the physical lattice are connected through log d distance in this extra dimension. Yeah. Yes. In general, you.
In practice, yes, but that is not the problem that follows from the answers. Uh-huh. Obviously, if you take your answers and you try to minimize the energy, they
cannot come with a numerical.
Exactly. So, but also in this casual part, there was no numerical optimization. Okay. The polynomial decay is built in.
So just a very simple numerical result here. So I'm just going to apply this mirror to just a simple critical icing model. So Pauli operators, XX and Z. I'm pretty sure everyone knows what an icing model is. So I have my ansatz, so I have some variational method which I optimize it for the ground state of this H. And then once I have the once I've optimized it, I just diagonalize these tensors I get out. So here are, so these this thing represents the spectrum of this operator when I diagonalize it. And I get exactly what I expect from the conformal field theory of the icing model, the icing CFT. So in this case, there are six primary fields. Okay, and you have these conformal towers where you have a primary field and then its descendants going up. So in the actual icing CFT, these towers would go all the way up to infinity. So you have an infinite number of descendants. With this numerical approach, with a finite bond dimension, you only get the largest scaling dimensions. So if I plotted what happens up here, it just becomes a mess. So these are the smaller scaling dimensions is what I get. The largest scaling dimensions you don't get, I'm sorry. So the largest ones contribute only very weakly to the energy, so you're not going to get them unless you increase your bond dimension a lot. And again, so even though we're working on the lattice the whole time, we reproduce this data of the field theory extremely accurately. Yeah, so we They no, they can fluctuate. It's not, yeah, they can be less or greater than, or maybe
just coincidence.
Just coincidence in this case.
So the scaling dimension is the property of this dissimilar
and size. Well,
and then operators.
You can get them just by diagonalizing the isometry in this way.
Right, so it depends on.
Yes.
And then you choose isometry for given Hamiltonian by optimizing.
Yes. So this comes from the optimization for Hamiltonian. Okay. And so to answer questions had previously, in practice we don't have every layer exactly the same, so you allow some layers at the bottom of your ansatz to have different tensors before you reach scale invariance, so transitional layers. So down here, this might be a two-dimensional index that has a spin up, like a spin index. Up here, it's generally a much larger index, so you choose some other bond dimension. So that's one reason for having these transitional layers. Another reason is you can get rid of any RG irrelevant terms in the Hamiltonian that screw up your scale invariance at small length scales. So maybe a Hamiltonian has some contribution that makes it not scale invariant when you're looking over short length scales. So we can get rid of that and we can really get this this proper long distance behavior using this lattice approach. Okay, and so somehow we've made sense of what it means to have scale invariance on the lattice with this approach. Yeah, so we have some change of scale on the lattice that seems to work.
Sorry, just a basic question. How did you compute the previous table from the previous slide? Did you compute the generated point function and solve several power laws?
You can just optimize your merit. You can get everything just from this one site guy. So you can use the one site, or there's these other two site ones. In general, they will give you the same spectrum up to maybe very small differences.
So the first eigenvalue will give one of the limits.
So you just diagonalize this guy, and this is the spectrum of that guy.
Because you start with the operator, then I can't go down to that one, so you get the second eigenvalue.
Only the
left half.
Okay, yeah. Well,
only one? The table is for local scaling operators. The right table is for non local scaling operators, the parents, which are
but
they both from a similar complexion, but not exactly the same.
Yes. So, yeah, okay. these ones are.
So, the ones you are mentioning are for the bubbles.
These ones are non-local and express instrument variables, but you can still get them just by changing this a little bit, which I'm not going to explain. Yeah.
Maybe this is a bit technical question. So you said that you optimize the energy, optimize these tensors for a given energy. Suppose you assume the scale invariance, because you tune your Hamiltonian away from the critical point. And then what did you get?
It depends on exactly how you do that. So if you try and use a scale invariant mirror for a non-critical Hamiltonian, it can still work in that if you have enough transitional layers, then your fixed point will just be a product state. You'll get a trivial fixed point. In general, it would not be a good idea to enforce scale invariance if you weren't at a scale invariant fixed point.
Is it guaranteed that your wave function always has this power correlation? By assuming scale invariance, is it guaranteed that your wave function always has this power correlation?
The what operation?
Power law.
Yeah. This is the previous derivation just. Where we got the expression for correlators just relied on the structural properties of this mirror. It holds for anyone. So
how do you attack that?
Maybe we can talk about that later. So we have ideas about how you could try and use this approach to find where it is. But, okay. At this point, I'm going to put the mirror aside for a little bit.
Just to see if I understand the question. The question is, how can we apply this if the theory is not critical?
Yeah, one.
If you don't know a priori if you are at a critical point or not. If you would allow the different layers to be different, wouldn't then effectively, if the system was not critical, wouldn't the tensors make it so that it will look like an MPS? Wouldn't the tensors try to mimic an MPS effect?
I don't
if you would allow different layers to be different.
If you allow different layers to be different and you apply it to a non-critical theory,
right.
You're going to go to a product state.
To what?
A trivial theory. Your effective theory will just become, at some length scale, will just become a product state. So, and again, if you're applying the scale invariant mirror to a gap system, as long as you have enough transition layers, it can still work in that your scale invariant part will just be mapping a product state to a product state. It will just be a trivial fixed point as opposed to an entangled fixed point. I mean, it's not a good idea to it's not very nice to do that. It's much simpler just to put a product state on top, if that's the case. Okay, so these were some very important properties of a conformal field theory, just a normal conformal field theory without an impurity. So scaling operators, scaling dimensions, and these tell you how the correlators between two scaling operators are allowed to decay in your theory. Okay. What happens if we have a critical theory, transcritical scale invariant theory, and now we add a local perturbation, or not necessarily a perturbation, a local term to our theory that breaks translation invariance. So this, we're going to consider what's called a conformal defect. So this new Hamiltonian is lacking translation invariance, but still has some, but still can be scale invariant. These have been studied in conformal field theory by starting with Cardi and others since then. So in the bulk, if we evaluate the expectation value of one of these scaling operators, it's always zero apart from the identity. And now, if we evaluate the expectation value of a bulk scaling operator when we have an impurity, what we get is things decay. Things are no longer zero, but they decay to zero as you move away from the impurity with the power of their scaling dimension. Okay, so one thing you can say here is I've added something local to the Hamiltonian, but the wave function, it has some very non-local effect on the wave function. So the wave function sees the presence of this impurity everywhere. So even potentially very far away from where I've added the impurity, I still have, I can still see the effect in the wave function when I measure one of these observables. So when I add an impurity, what conformal field theory tells us is we should add some new set of scaling operators and scaling dimensions associated to this impurity, and that these manifest when I evaluate a correlator between a scaling operator of the impurity located at the impurity and a scaling operator in the bulk. So I get these new powers of polynomial decay possible according to these impurity scaling operators. Okay, so these are the defining sort of physics of critical systems with impurities that we would like to have an approach to capture. Okay, so polynomial decay of local operators with distance from the impurity, and a new set of scaling operators and scaling dimensions associated to the impurity. Okay, what would happen if I just try and analyze a Hamiltonian that I've added an impurity to with just naively with the mirror? Well, first of all of our construction falls apart. So initially, we wanted to set all of the tensors in a row as the same. And now, of course, we can't do that. And then if we can't set tensors in each row the same, then we can't choose the layers the same either. So in principle, you could try and analyze a Hamiltonian like this with a mirror, but you would need to choose all your tensors differently. So you'd have order n different tensors as opposed to order one different tensors for the previous case. So it would not be very nice, and you can't enforce scale invariance exactly in this case. But we're going to try and find a better way of doing these impurity systems. Okay. So imagine I have the ground state of the Hamiltonian, the bulk one, in terms of a mirror. Is there anything I can say about the ground state of the Hamiltonian with the impurity? Is there any relation between this phi naught and this phi one I can draw or propose? And so what I'm going to propose in terms of relationship between phi naught and phi one is that to get between the two, I only need to change what happens inside the causal cone of this impurity. Okay, so this, so for reasons that may become clear later, we call this, say, a principle of minimal influence in the RG flow. So rather than changing my whole structure as a response to this impurity, I only change what happens in a very specific place, the causal cone of where this impurity lies. So this is, what's the time, Giffrey?
It's 15 minutes left, but you start too late because
of you. So we're not going to, we don't have any proof of why this should work, and it's certainly not obvious why it should work. So as I argued before, the wave function in response to an impurity changes everywhere. So it's not clear I should only change a small number of tensors to account for this. But hopefully I can convince you through a number of ways, including numerical evidence, that this is a good idea to do. So there are some exceptions where this clearly wouldn't work. So one is where you have symmetry breaking in the bulk, where the way, so maybe the way, in this case, the way you would, the proper way to break the symmetry in the bulk may depend on what impurity you want to put in later, so it may not be work. And before I analyze this impurity mirror, I'm just going to slightly change it. So this is a perfectly good impurity mirror, but what I'm going to do is replace it with a more convenient form. So first of all, I just do some tensor decomposition on just some of these ternary isometries into a pair of binary isometries. Then when I go to change things in the causal cone, so this principle of minimal influence says I should change what happens in the causal cone and leave everything outside the same. What I'm going to do is just replace everything inside the causal cone with a simpler structure. So this is just for convenience for numerical purposes, and also makes things easier to explain as well, just having one tensor inside this causal cone. So it's nothing, this is just a trick. We're not doing anything fundamental here. Okay. And if this ANSATZ works, then it will be great, because we're somehow still exploiting the translation invariance of the bulk part. We can also explicitly enforce that this layer is the same as this layer, so scale invariance. And the cost is order one, so it's the same as the bulk mirror. We just have essentially one new tensor to optimize, the one that belongs to the impurity. So let's look at properties of this impurity mirror. Again, without talking about how the tensors are chosen, just the structural properties. If I put a bulk scaling operator some distance d from the impurity, what is the expectation value of this operator? Well, what I can see is that in terms of coarse graining, it just coarse grains as usual. So it just moves through the bulk distance log d just as before. Okay, so again, it picks up, if you apply the scaling superoperator log d times to this operator, you get the same operator back with some factor according to its scaling dimension, so polynomial. Okay, and then once it's here, can, the next step, it sort of fuses into the impurity, and here you can pick up some non-zero constant for when it shifts into the impurity. So if this constant is non-zero, which it can be, then when I evaluate this local expectation value, it's proportionate to the distance that it was from the impurity to the power of its scaling dimension. So this, again, this is just a purely structural property, looking at this ANSATZ and saying that something, an operator d distant from the impurity, sees the impurity after log d steps. So just the geometric things. Okay, what happens when I have a two-point correlator between an object at the impurity and one away from the impurity? So the pink one scales as usual. The one located at the impurity scales with just in the same way, but we have a new scaling operator. So this one we add the impurity is independent of the isometry here. It can be completely different. So it has, in principle, a new set of scaling operators and scaling dimensions associated to this operator that just lives in the impurity. Okay, so the correct way, again, the same trick, just diagonalize this operator and look at its scaling operators and scaling dimensions. And from that, what we can say, so if I want to evaluate this correlator, this one moves up log d times according to the impurity scaling superoperator. This one moves up log d times according to the bulk scaling operator. So when I evaluate this correlator as some constant divided by d to the power of the bulk scaling dimension and the impurity scaling dimension to get here. So what we've seen is that so these are the properties, these are the relevant physics for a critical system with an impurity from conformal field theory, and we have this very simple, nice ansatz that seems to reproduce all of these properties just from the structure of this ansatz. Okay. So I'm very briefly going to talk about the implementation of this, not the technical details, just a sketch of how you would optimize the structure. Okay. So as I've argued before, these tensors here just belong to the bulk, so I just get them exactly the same way, just as the normal scale invariant mirror, just by looking at this bulk Hamiltonian, just optimizing that. Yeah, so exactly the same as previous. And now I have to optimize somehow these tensors that live at the impurity. And what I'm going to do to simplify this is I'm going to map this original impurity Hamiltonian to some Hamiltonian that lives on the surface of this causal cone. So I'll explain a bit more about that in a second. And then once I have this effective problem that lives on this new lattice, I'm going to optimize that problem for these impurity tensors, these Vs.
Are those binary operators somehow part of your V, or did you somehow optimize
them? Yeah, this is some trickery. So these ones here,
they
come from just some decomposition of the ternary one. So once I have this, I can get to this. So it's part of the bulk. It doesn't rely on impurity. It's just some trickery. It's not necessary. Okay. So step one, just the normal scale invariant optimization I'm not going to talk about. Let's look at this mapping here. So what I've drawn here is just my impurity mirror in a schematic way without drawing the tensors. So bulk tensors and some causal cone and where the impurity tensors live. And what I've drawn up here is so the initial lattice and this red lattice and these bulk tensors here. So this shows you the mapping between the initial Hamiltonian that lives down here and this Hamiltonian, that this effective Hamiltonian that lives on this the surface of this causal cone. Okay, and we call this the log scale lattice for obvious reasons. Yeah, each site here corresponds to exponentially many sites here as you move away. So this is very similar to the mapping I was showing before, except of course it's now sort of non-homogeneous in the directions. But so three Hamiltonian terms here, three couplings get mapped to a single effective coupling up there. As I move away, now nine couplings get mapped to this next one here, and so forth, 27. In terms of just this, when we coarse grain in the bulk, for a critical theory, the Hamiltonian is a scaling operator with some fixed scaling dimension two. So for us, this implies that if I have a critical Hamiltonian here, if I coarse grain it properly, I'll get back the same Hamiltonian up here, but with some factor over three. And what does this imply for this mapping to the log scale lattice? It implies that that I have the same coupling everywhere on this lattice, but I've picked up some exponentially decaying weight for this new coupling. So I have a new coupling H tilde, but its weight decays exponentially as I move away from the origin. Okay? So I started from my initial impurity problem, I mapped it to a new impurity problem that lives on this causal cone. And I want to optimize these impurity tensors from this new problem. I'm just going to draw it a bit differently. So just to simplify things, I'm just going to fold the problem at the origin. Okay, so I want to solve a one-dimensional Hamiltonian, the boundary that has this form, with this tensor network ansatz. And if you're familiar with Wilson's approach to the Kondo impurity problem, so a magnetic impurity in a metal is a very important problem in physics. What you can see is that this effective problem is exactly the same effective problem as Wilson reached. So Wilson started with the Kondo problem in momentum space. He discretized momentum space in some way. He had all these mappings. And the end result of that is he arrived at some effective problem for the impurity, which is the same one we arrive at with our approach, starting from a very different place. So the good news about this is Wilson already found a very nice way of solving for this Hamiltonian, like this. So Wilson's approach, he invented this approach called NRG, numerical renormalization group, where you just truncate your Hilbert space just by diagonalizing the Hamiltonian on the finite block, keeping the smallest energy eigenvalues, and just repeating this procedure with larger and larger blocks. And that works in this case because of this exponential decay of operators, so the separation of energy scales. So we can do something similar with the mirror, but we do maybe slightly use some of these more sophisticated techniques that come later also. Okay, so just simple benchmark results now. So again, just a 1D IC model, and now I add a cross-spun link. I add a stronger or a weaker interaction between two of the spins. In terms of some alpha, so alpha equals 1, it's no impurity. And for these different values of alpha, this is just looking at the magnetization from this impurity mirror. So for each value of alpha, you get this nice polynomial decay to the bulk value, as you would expect, as we derived before. So with this impurity mirror, even very far away from the impurity, thousands, tens of thousands, millions of sites, you're still reproducing the correct impurity effect on the magnetization to very high precision. Okay. In terms of these scaling dimensions, so for each different value of the impurity, I get a completely new set of scaling dimensions and scaling operators that live at the impurity. Okay, so this plot shows some of the scaling dimensions as a function of this this coupling strength at the impurity. Okay, so in this extreme case, alpha equals 0, I've chosen an impurity that removes any coupling between the left and the right half of the chain. Alpha equals 1 is no impurity, and we have an infinitely strong impurity. And so over this entire regime, you reproduce the exact results to high precision. So these blue lines are the exact results from conformal field theory.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
The previous picture, since you have a finite magnetization, that means you are away from critical points.
No.
Because in the criticalizing chain, the magnetization is 0.
The Z magnetization. So in the critical icing chain, the Z magnetization is this value 0.6 something.
Now, at the critical point, it's, see, the Z magnetic field is supposed to take you from the x y order to the other arm. So at the critical point, there is no magnetization.
So sigma x is 0. Sigma x is 0.
There's no magnetization in the x. There's always going to be magnetization in the direction of your magnetic field, which is what we're measuring. So this is still critical. So at the critical point, it's still magnetization Z is 0.6 something.
I see. Sorry.
No, that's all good. So get on to the summary. I must be the time you're through.
Well, just a little late, so
okay. 5 minutes. Okay, so we had this principle of minimal influence. So we're saying when I change something down here, I should only change, well, I can get away with only changing what happens in this causal cone. And this led to the idea of an impurity mirror, which is a very nice ansatz. So even though your problem is lacking translational invariance, you can still exploit the translational invariance in the bulk, and you can still enforce the scale invariance. So we saw this is a very natural variational ansatz for systems with an impurity. So you get the correlators and local observables just from the structure of imposing this. And we saw that the effect of a problem you get for this impurity is actually very similar to the one Wilson got in his solution to the Kondo problem. But Wilson's approach relied on the bulk part of your system being free fermions in order to make this mapping. For us, in principle, the bulk can be anything interacting. It doesn't matter, and you can still do this mapping and use this approach. So I'll just quickly talk about some extensions. So if you have multiple impurities, it works in roughly the same way. So the causal cone of two impurities will fuse into a single causal cone, sort of at some distance log d. We won't go through this, but we can still do multiple impurities. We have results, they look nice. If you have an open boundary, you just using this principle of minimal influence, you can convince yourself that this should be a good ansatz for open boundary systems. So just one layer of tensors on this open boundary, and it works. You can also stitch together if you have two different types of bulk system interacting at a point. You can also convince yourself that this is a good ansatz for that, where you now have two different types of bulk tensors that come from each of the bulks separately. So in terms of this, I think this is a very nice, in terms of this sort of holographic understanding that Giffrey was talking about, where we somehow related what's happening in our d-dimensional Hamiltonian to what's happening in our d plus one dimensional ground state is represented by a mirror. So we can understand how a local change here affects this wave function, which is, in all cases, you're just sort of stretching things out in the extra dimension. Yeah, it's very nice and very simple. So I've already talked about these points. I might just skip all that.
Oh,
yeah.
What about the disordered system? So if you have a disordered Eisen chain in transverse field where the coupling and the random variables, can you still apply this method in some way?
So this method relies on you have a system you can solve. If you can solve like a Hamiltonian, then the Hamiltonian plus a local term you can solve in some nicer way. So I'm not sure if you have a random coupling, I don't think it would help you. So if it's a random coupling, you're changing the Hamiltonian everywhere from the bulk case. So changing it everywhere, this will not help you. Okay, so that's all I'll say. Oh, thanks for the talk. I have a picture of the All Blacks because they just won the World Cup recently in rugby. So it's not often that New Zealand wins something, so it's worth bragging about.